Well, good morning. Is anyone here angry? That's good. We don't like a hostile audience. Anger actually is good in the right context. Jesus was angry when the people tried to turn God's holy temple into a den of thieves. And a couple of months ago, Randy shared with us some shocking statistics about how many young people lose their Christian faith when they go to high school and college. And I think it's directly related to the amount of time and the pervasive amount of teaching of evolution that you get in school and in the media, as opposed to how well generally pastors and parents can counter that with the amount of amazing evidence that there is for the creationist view. So my point in making this presentation is to share with you what I learned about creation and what I learned about evolution. And let me tell you, it made me angry when I realized how much I'd been lied to. You see, you may not realize it, but there is a war going on. It's a battle for our children's minds, but not just our children alone, because they grow up to be adults, and adults perpetuate the same things that they've been taught. The ruse is to keep teaching of creation and intelligent design out of the schools in the guise of not teaching religion. But in so doing, the religion of atheism and secular humanism is being taught. And those people who believe in atheism and secular humanism would like to eliminate God and God-like things from our lives. So the need for this presentation is that there's a lot of pseudoscience, baloney, smoke and mirrors, and facade out there, which we need to use our common sense and our logic to strip away. And that'll reveal what is true science and what is actually blind faith. So in my presentation, I'm going to talk a little bit about that, a little bit about philosophy and worldviews. We're going to do some definitions so that everyone's on the same page, and then I'll jump right into all this evidence, evidence. And you won't have time to take notes, because I'm going to go fast. You're going to have to listen as quickly as you can. And so what I've done is I've printed out a little handout of some of the key things to remember. So don't even look at that yet. It'll be coming to you. And if you can hold off, if you have any questions, maybe after the presentation. And if you say, well, gee, I really missed that, this is being recorded, so it should be able to be re-seen by you at another time. Well, my background is that I grew up in Southern California, and I had a really wonderful life. I was carefree and self-assured and even felt sort of invincible. I always had a positive attitude. I never thought about death or dying. I believed in God because my parents told me that he existed. And I always thought that science, technology, and good government would solve all of the world's problems. Well, as I grew a little older, I realized that scientists don't have all the answers, and politicians certainly don't have the answers. And I found myself becoming really unsettled when watching the news on TV from a standpoint of reality rather than optimism. Later, when I moved to BC, I was talking to my wife's brother-in-law, and he was talking to me about prophecy. And I said, prophecy, what's prophecy? Well, he said that this book is the only book known to man, the Bible, which contains hundreds and hundreds of prophecies which have been written in great detail and have come to pass with absolute accuracy. I came to realize that, in essence, that is God's signature of authorship on that book. And I said, oh my gosh, if that's true, I have to believe it. I determined that if you could know absolute truth from God himself, that's what I wanted to know, because it directly concerned my future. I became fully convinced, based on archaeological, historical, and prophetical evidence, that this Bible is absolutely true and reliable. But now I had a problem, because my whole life, right up through 9 years of university sciences, I'd been taught that evolution was a fact, and a scientific fact, and that creation is just religion. And I determined that I had to know what actually was true, what is religion, and which one is science. Well, really, there are only two choices. We either evolved or we were created. Now, sometimes people talk about being seeded by aliens, but really that just pushes the debate off to another planet where you still have to decide whether or not the aliens were evolved or whether they were created. So in this presentation, I'll be giving you a lot of information from a lot of different scientific disciplines. And what I want you to do is consider using common sense and logic to see whether the evidence best supports creation or evolution. And I'd like you to consider each piece of evidence that I give you as just a thin strand of dental floss. Since one strand of evidence doesn't hold much weight, my question is for you, how much evidence do you require? This is really important, and I'd like you to think seriously about it. For example, if someone was to dangle you over the Lion's Gate Bridge, how thick of a rope would you require in order to feel secure? Well, if each piece of evidence I give you is like a strand of dental floss, how thick of a rope of truth, if you will, would you require in order to find yourself secure in believing in God as creator rather than in believing in evolution? Well, this rope probably has about 2,000 strands in it, and if I gave you 2,000 strands of evidence this morning which directly supported creation and stood against evolution, would you find that adequate? You got it. You get 2,000 strands this morning. So let's start looking at all this evidence we've been talking about. Well, this animal looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck. So we already have three pieces of evidence to indicate that it's a duck. But what if a zoologist with a PhD came in here and insisted that it's a horse? Well, our common sense and logic would tell us that he is clearly lying. But the question is, would we be easily misled? Would we say, well, he is the expert? So let's find out. In Nebraska, in 1922, a tooth was found that experts from the American Museum of Natural History deemed to be partly like that of a human and partly like that of an ape. They couldn't decide whether the tooth was from a man-like ape or from an ape-like man, but a two-page spread, along with a picture depicting Nebraska man, his wife, and the tools that they were using, was published in the Illustrated London Times and distributed worldwide. All of this from one tooth, which was later discovered to have been from an extinct pig. You know, one time I was driving through the southeastern portion of the United States, and I was lost, and I stopped and asked a fellow if he could tell me how to get to a certain place. And his answer was, well, you can't get there from here. And I said, all right, fine. Can you tell me how to get to a place where I can get there from there? And his eyes sort of glazed over, and he didn't really have a good answer for me. But the fact of the matter is, I have a doctorate in dentistry, and you cannot get there from there. Someone is making up a lot of stuff here. So my question is, are evolutionists just seeing what they want to see, or does the deception run deeper than that? Well, in November of 1999, National Geographic published a cover story on Archaeoraptor, as they called it, certainly a more scientific-sounding name than if they had called it a birdosaur. It was written as breaking news. It had all sorts of great illustrations and artists' renderings, and it was all very professional and polished. It was written to convince the readers of the facts concerning the reality of the dinosaur in your backyard. And it was quite thorough as to its evolutionary ancestry and development. The only problem is that the whole thing was a fabrication and a hoax. This hoax came to light very shortly after the article was published, and some months later, National Geographic even published a retraction, but it was fairly noncommittal, about two paragraphs long and buried in the middle of a magazine. Well, since then, they've also done another article on that, and some of these pictures are actually from that article. Well, Storrs Olson, the curator of birds at the Smithsonian Institute's Museum of Natural History, and an outspoken skeptic of the bird-dinosaur link, says that he warned the magazine that there were serious problems with the fossil. Olson says, at some point, the fossil was known by Geographic to be a fake, and that information was not revealed. This article just goes on to say more about the fraudulent fossils, but you have to realize that even if the fossil was legitimate, the entire article, pictures, dates, and everything are entirely speculation and smoke and mirrors conjured up from an evolutionary bias. Well, does that make you angry? That makes me angry. The problem is that by then the damage was done, and millions of people have now seen this birdosaur on the cover of National Geographic magazine without even having necessarily read the article. They think it's a fact because they've seen the picture, and after all, this is a reputable scientific magazine, right? Well, Hitler said, if you tell a lie long enough, loud enough, and often enough, the people would believe it. And I think you should also add, and with enough conviction. The evolutionists are adamant about their conviction. And many people, such as teachers, are just passing along the very things that they themselves have been taught. He also said, people are more likely to believe a big lie than a small one. Well, how does this relate to evolution? Dr. Tien Tamisian of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission has said, and I quote, scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact. And I think that National Geographic article is an excellent example of that statement. So is creation science or is it religion? Is evolution science or religion? Once again, using common sense and logic, I want us to look at where the evidence points. Another objective for me this morning is for us to discover whether or not God really exists. And if so, what are the implications of this? I'd like you to imagine that you're going on a survival outing for a month. Just how well you survive for that month, in fact, if you even survive at all, depends on how well you would know your survival manual. You'd want to know, for example, where to find water, what plants in the area are edible, what to do in case of a snake bite. Well, our survival on this earth and in our future is dependent on how well we know our survival manual, which has been written by one who knows everything that we're going to face. Now, some people don't necessarily believe that. Some philosophers don't believe that. Friedrich Nietzsche, the famous French philosopher, used to say, God is dead. And then one day God said, Nietzsche is dead, and he settled that whole issue. But down through the ages, philosophers have asked four big questions, and these are things that they really want to know. And the answers to which are quite different depending on whether or not you believe in God and creation, or whether you believe in evolution with its atheistic basis. The four big questions are, who am I? How did I get here? Why am I here? And where am I going? It's interesting that the first two questions are asking what our origins are, but the last two questions are actually dependent on what our origins are. So let's look at a contrast in the answers that you get from a belief in evolution as compared to what God says in the Bible. Who am I? Am I just a freak accident, or am I God's personal creation? How did I get here? Was it just by random chance, or did God lovingly knit me together like a tapestry in my mother's womb? Why am I here? Is there no real valid reason for being alive, or has God purposed me to experience his love and a personal relationship with him and my fellow man? Where am I going? Am I just heading for death in the grave to become so much worm chow? In that case, why even put up with the hardships of life? Actually, this very lack of purpose and meaning in life is the basis of many teenage suicides. But God says that he has prepared a place for me that is so incredible that eye has not seen, ear has not heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for them that love him. It's our worldview, either with or without God, which leads you to either an endless hope or a hopeless end. And it's pretty obvious that believing in creation can give you a far more positive attitude and an outlook, but I really didn't care what was positive. I just wanted to know what was true. And like I said, my whole life, right up through 9 years of university sciences, I had been taught that creation is religion and that evolution is factual science. And then I had been tested and graded on how well I believed that. Well, I came to realize that if you're only taught one side of a controversial issue, you're not being educated, you're being indoctrinated. It was when I began to believe the Bible that I found myself compelled to find out what is the truth, what is science, and what is religion. Well, firstly, neither creation nor evolution can be considered scientific fact in the classical sense of the word, because there was no human around at the beginning to observe his own origin. And it's only a one-time only, non-repeatable event. If science means to know through observation and study, then we should be searching for answers without preemptively eliminating some of them. But evolutionary scientists have redefined science as explaining natural events by natural causes, because they refuse to allow a supernatural foot in the door. Sir Arthur Keith, who wrote the foreword to the 100th anniversary edition of Darwin's book, Origin of the Species, has said, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it only because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable." That's like being in a math class, and on the first day the instructor says to you, "Class, I want you to know before we even start, there is no number four. The number four does not exist. Now, who can tell me what 2 + 2 is?" How absurd, how senseless, if incorrect answers are allowed, but a possible correct answer is forbidden. Whoops, there we go. So I think we shouldn't limit science by looking at nature without God. I think we have to consider God as a possible correct answer. So what is a scientific fact? And what's the difference between that and a historical fact? A scientific fact is something that happens in the present. It is repeatable, and it's observed by someone. An historical fact, on the other hand, happened in the past, and it's not repeatable, but it was still observed by someone. But what if something happened in the past, is not repeatable, and it was not observed? Well, then it's a conjecture, an interpretation, a speculation, a guess, but it is not and cannot be a scientific fact. So if someone tells you that evolution is a scientific fact, even if it's National Geographic magazine, you can be assured that they're lying, or at least that they have an agenda or a bias, because by definition it cannot be a scientific fact. And that is why you'll not hear me saying that I can prove creation as a fact, but rather that that is where the evidence points. Well, everyone has a bias, and that flavors how you interpret the data. Generally, evolutionists interpret their data in agreement with their bias, and actually so do creationists. But you know, I fully believed in evolution until I suddenly fully believed in creation. So I think I was about as unbiased a guy as you could possibly find. I just wanted to know what was true. So let's see if we can determine what the evidence for our origin actually is. And let's start with some definitions so we're all on the same page. Bear with me, we are getting to the evidence. The term evolution can just mean change over time. And even creationists do not have a problem believing that things change over time. It's interesting, for example, that people refer to the evolution of the automobile, meaning change over time. But nobody believes it evolved by random chance, but rather that it was changed by the creative and intelligent designers who planned and instituted changes. Following that same logic, intelligent design theory indicates that it was a purposeful, intelligent designer to whom all creation and biological life owes its existence, and it uses only scientific evidence to support that. Creation theory uses all the same scientific evidence to show that creation and biological life owes its existence to a purposeful, intelligent designer and creator, but then it also proceeds to explain who he is and how and why he revealed himself to us. While evolutionists occasionally use the evolution term to mean change over time, they're actually using it to mean that undirected mechanistic processes can account for all of the diverse and complex living organisms that exist or have existed, and that there is no long-range plan, purpose, or intent directing what happens. This is better defined as macroevolution. So macroevolution is really a better term for what evolutionists are referring to when they speak of evolution. And it refers to the emergence of major innovations by unguided development. Basically, an increase of new genetic information and complexity. This is generally the molecules to microbes to man hypothesis of evolution, or from the goo to you by way of the zoo. And you should know that this has never been observed scientifically. Microevolution is really just a poor choice of wording that seems to lend credibility to the idea of evolution, and it's basically referring to genetic variation or adaptation within a species. For example, light and dark peppered moths were always given as a great illustration of evolution, but they both exist at the same time and nothing has evolved. So now we'll start looking at all the evidence that I've been talking about, and please keep in mind that common sense and logic. Can a frog turn into a prince instantly? The evolutionists would admit that a frog turning into a prince instantly is just a fairy tale. And yet they seem to say that it did happen over the course of millions and billions of years. And they say that's science. I say it's BS. Bad science. Or better still, non-science. You see, for a frog to turn into a prince instantly, we have to pretend that there is a mechanism by which that could happen. And this pretend mechanism is given a name. It's called magic. But magic is really a hollow word because there is no mechanism that makes the magic actually work. Well, there is also no mechanism by which a frog can turn into a prince over millions or billions of years. But the evolutionists pretend that there is, and they actually give it a name. They call it evolution. And here is the formula. Nothing plus time plus chance equals everything. So let's analyze this for a minute. I'm not kidding here. Nothing by itself is nothing and does nothing. Well, what about time and chance? Well, firstly, time and chance have to have something to work on. They can't just work on nothing. But to give you an idea of how it's meant to work, I'd like you to imagine that we had several decks of cards here. And if we wanted to spell something out in the parking lot, if we just threw the cards out the back window, nothing would get spelled. And the reason, according to evolutionary principles, is because there is not enough time for chance to operate on these cards randomly and sort them out so that they could spell something out in the parking lot. So if we took a plane up to 10,000 feet and threw the cards out the window, there is now plenty of time for chance to work on these cards and randomly sort them out to spell something in the parking lot. Keep in mind that according to the definition of evolution, we cannot even ask for something specific to be spelled because we're relying on, as it said, undirected mechanistic processes with no plan, purpose, or intent directing the outcome. Well, obviously, this would not happen because time and chance are the enemy of organization and work towards increased randomness. Now, some people will add energy to this equation, for example, energy from the sun and photosynthesis in plants. But without a specific mechanism to capture the energy and a specific mechanism to utilize the energy, all that happens is you get a speeding up of your destruction, like the fading of paint or the cracking of rubber tires. Incidentally, the only reason that evolutionists believe in millions and billions of years for the age of the Earth is that they know that life forms couldn't evolve in a short amount of time. However, many dating methods do point to an age of the Earth in the 6 to 10,000 year range, and the only thing that makes that statement hard to believe is the indoctrination that we've been raised on. The science is there to support a young Earth, and as I'll show you, life couldn't evolve in a long amount of time either. So let's look at the other supposed driving forces of evolution. They are natural selection and random mutations. Keep in mind that evolution would require an increase in new genetic information. An example of natural selection is if a bear is chasing a fat fellow and a thin fellow, and he catches and eats the fat one. Well, nature has now selected for thin people. But nothing new has evolved. You already had both of the men, and now you've effectively eliminated half of your genetic information. So natural selection speaks to the extinction and elimination of genetic information, but it doesn't speak to the evolution of it. Actually, a good way to explain that would be to say that the survival of the fittest does not explain the arrival of the fittest. Well, random mutations in DNA are kind of like bugs or glitches in your computer. They don't make your computer run better or improve the program. Virtually every mutation is a genetic information losing process. So believing in evolution based on mutations is like asking, how much genetic information does a bacteria have to lose in order for it to become a human? Well, the next slide is an interview with Professor Richard Dawkins, one of the world's foremost evolutionists, where he is being asked if he can give an example of an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the genetic information in the genome. This, by the way, would be an absolute requirement for new species to arise and for macroevolution to be a fact. In essence, the interviewer is giving Dawkins an opportunity to show him a mechanism to prove that evolution is not a hollow word like magic.
Professor Dawkins, can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome?
There's a popular misunderstanding of evolution which says that fish turned into reptiles and reptiles turned into mammals, and so somehow we ought to be able to look around the world today and look at our ancestors. We ought to be able to see the intermediates between fish and reptiles, or between reptiles and mammals. We ought to be able to see fish kind of on the way to becoming reptiles. But of course that's not the way it is at all. Fish are modern animals. They're just as...
Well, did you notice that after that long gap where Professor Dawkins did not have an answer to the interviewer's question, that he went ahead and answered a completely different question that he wasn't asked? The conclusion? There are no known genetic mutations or evolutionary processes which can be seen to increase the information in the genome, which, as I have said, would have been an absolute requirement for a species to arise or for macroevolution to be a fact. So is evolution a fact or a hypothesis? Well, let's continue looking at the evidence. When Sir Isaac Newton discovered the law of gravity, he began with a hypothesis, an idea, which gradually became a theory as confirming evidence increased, until it was finally proven as a law. Gravity is so definitive that it is measurable. Aerodynamic engineers have learned that by applying the appropriate amount of thrust and lift, you can temporarily override gravity. But if you turn off an airplane's engine in mid-flight, you'll have sudden empirical evidence that the law of gravity is still in effect. And thank God it is. Can you imagine if every time you had people over for a snack, you put out a plate of cookies and they immediately floated to the ceiling? What do you think a science teacher would say if you came up with a hypothesis like this? Sir, I think everything that has chocolate chips in it will just naturally float to the ceiling. Well, a science teacher would say, your pathetic hypothesis contradicts a known law. I think you had better sit down and learn something about science. And yet, that is exactly what the hypothesis of evolution does. In biology, we have the law of biogenesis, which says that life comes only from life. For many years, scientists had hypothesized that life appeared by spontaneous generation. If you left rotting meat out in the sun, maggots would spontaneously appear. Well, we now know that flies would come along and lay their eggs in the rotting meat, and subsequently maggots would appear. In the 1800s, Louis Pasteur and others proved that spontaneous generation does not occur and that biogenesis was proven as a law. Just as in the case where the person hypothesized that the mere presence of chocolate chips will somehow reverse the law of gravity, evolution is just bad science, and we remember what the abbreviation for that is, because it too contradicts a known and proven scientific law. So in the sense of nothing becoming molecules, becoming proteins, and then slimy algae and on up the evolutionary ladder, is definitely not a fact. It's not even a theory. It's only a hypothesis, and a bad one at that. So why would brilliant scientists believe in evolution? The answer to that is that it's not a scientific issue, but rather a moral one, and a lack of an acceptance of God. Nobel Prize-winning scientist Dr. George Vald has admitted, and I quote, "One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation." Well, did you notice the lack of common sense and logic here? To avoid admitting a creator, he would prefer to cling to a bad hypothesis which was disproved 200 years ago? That makes me angry. He's supposed to be scientific. He's supposed to be a Nobel Prize winner. Well, what are we to make of a brilliant human being like this? The Word of God says in Psalms 14 and 53, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." And in Romans 1:22, it says, "Professing to be wise, they became fools." So let's look at some statements of some evolutionists who are more intellectually honest than George Vald. Colin Paterson, the senior paleontologist at the prestigious British Museum of Natural History, which houses the world's largest fossil collection, some 60 million specimens, has confessed, "If I knew of any evolutionary transitions, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them in my book, Evolution." His statement underscores the fact that the fossil record is an embarrassment to evolutionists. No verifiable transitions from one species to another have as yet been found. This doctrinaire evolutionist has also admitted, "For over 20 years, I thought I was working on evolution, but there was not one thing I knew about it. So for the past few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people and groups of people. The question is, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true? I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar in the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists. And all I got there was silence for a long time, and eventually one person said, yes, I do know one thing, it ought not to be taught in high school." Colin Paterson goes on to say, "During the past few years, you've experienced a shift from evolution as knowledge to evolution as faith. Evolution not only conveys no knowledge, but seems somehow to convey anti-knowledge." So let's look at some other laws of physical science that contradict the hypothesis of evolution. The first law of thermodynamics is basically that matter and energy are neither created nor destroyed. Scientists know that the universe is not infinite based on the second law of thermodynamics. And although this law is perfectly consistent with creation and a creator, it wreaks havoc with evolutionary cosmology. Similarly, the law of cause and effect, that every effect has a cause which is greater than the effect itself, is consistent with creation, but big problems for evolution. The second law of thermodynamics is a good one to dwell on for a while, because basically it indicates that all things go from order to chaos without the input of energy and intelligence, or to a lower level of energy in the instance of crystalline structures, but that's irrelevant for this talk. In other words, if you planted a nice, neat garden with proper rows and labels and nicely weeded it, you would come back, and then you went away for a couple of years, you'd come back to find everything overgrown with weeds, the local wildlife would have eaten all your vegetables, and the row mounds would have eroded and washed away, and basically you'd be back to no garden at all, just the randomness that you began with. Another example is, if you left a car in your yard for a million years, would some future generation come back and find it more restored than the way you left it? I submit it would deteriorate just to rust and dust. Well, let's use some common sense here, common sense and logic. The evolutionists make things sound like evolution progresses and just is kind of on hold for thousands or millions of years, waiting for the next step to happen. So let's help them out and see what really would happen. What is the closest thing to actual life that you can think of? Something that has just died. It already has all the necessary proteins and organs and structures, and everything is in order and in the right place. So what if you covered the entire Earth with dead birds? Would you say, yeah, they're so close, just another 10,000 years and they'll all be up and walking around? Well, what do bird carcasses look like in just a couple of years? Just some bones and some feathers and dust. Certainly not closer to life than when it first died. And that's the second law of thermodynamics in action. It's the breaking things down. But we don't think about this, and evolutionists would not encourage us to. So are we seeing these things with common sense and logic? In fact, there is only one place in the entire universe where there is an obvious contradiction to this known law and proven law. And that is in the supposedly scientific textbooks that are teaching evolution as a fact. And that makes me angry. The Bible says, avoid the profane and vain babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called science. Well, you've all seen a picture similar to this one, showing how all the species are related to common ancestors, where supposedly molecules became proteins, which became cells, and then multicellular organisms, and on to sponges, worms, cylinderates, clams, to the vertebrates like fishes, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. You remember I quoted Dr. Colin Patterson, who said, if I knew of any evolutionary transitions, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them in my book. Well, let's look at what Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, the evolutionist's evolutionist, had to say about the transitional forms. He says, and I quote, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. Well, what he calls the rest is also termed missing links. And if the missing links are inference and not the evidence of fossils, I don't see how he can call them reasonable. I would also like to point out that extreme rarity, according to Dr. Colin Patterson, is better translated non-existence. So what is he really saying when he says this? He says, in essence, the non-existence of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. And in the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks, the missing links are all inference and not the evidence of fossils. Well, when has any teacher or textbook ever told us this, let alone one of the world's foremost evolutionists? I guess that's why it's a trade secret. Well, are these missing links in the process of a knife evolving into a fork? There they are. Actually, this shows that even if you were to find something with characteristics partly like that of other things, it doesn't mean that they are related or that one is in the process of turning into the other. The fossil record should actually show continuous gradual variation and enough links that one species blends into another and another and another. They aren't missing links, they're missing the entire chain. Well, what is something that's missing? It's really something that's not there, but the evolutionists are trying to imply that it was. They used to say that we didn't see any transitional fossils because macroevolution happened so slowly, thus the requirement of the age of the Earth in the millions of and billions of years. But Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, in trying to find an explanation for why there are no transitional fossils, has proposed the hypothesis of punctuated equilibrium. According to Gould's hypothesis of punctuated equilibrium, he says, and I quote, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. Well, this newest fairy tale produced and proliferated in the evolutionary community is basically just a rehash of Richard Goldschmidt's hopeful monster hypothesis. This German geneticist sums up his sentiments as follows, and I quote, the major evolutionary advances must have taken place in single large steps. The many missing links in the paleontological record are sought for in vain because they have never existed. The first bird hatched from a reptilian egg, and I'm sensing more bad science. So are these evolutionary trees representative of what we observe in science? No, they are not. Actually, what scientists find is that all organisms seem to have sprung into existence with no precursive ancestry, fully formed and identical to modern organisms, except perhaps for their size, but not because of punctuated equilibrium. More like individual blades of grass than interconnected branches on a tree. And some of these lines are shorter than others as various organisms have gone extinct. But now I'm going to show you how irrelevant all those missing links are by going back to the very first step. Dr. Stanley Miller wanted to demonstrate that life could have taken place without an intelligent creator through naturalistic means. So he designed an experiment to show that there was no designer. Kind of an oxymoron. He was proposing what the ancient atmosphere must have been like, and this experiment did yield amino acids, which are called the building blocks of life. The scientific community The scientific community indicated that we were on the verge of creating life in a test tube. At least that's what I was taught. But let's have a look at what they didn't teach me. As an example, if the Earth's early atmosphere consisted of butter, flour, sugar, and the earthquakes mixed everything together and the lightning strokes and the volcanic activity heated it up, you could get sugar cookies by naturalistic means. Well, that is exactly what Stanley Miller did. He knew the results he wanted to get and proposed, without any evidence for it, a primitive atmosphere with the ingredients of ammonia, methane, hydrogen, and water, because he knew that would give him what he wanted. Well, here are the problems. He couldn't have oxygen in the system because he knows that oxygen breaks down amino acids. So he proposed what we call a reducing atmosphere with those assorted chemicals. But with no oxygen in the atmosphere, there is also no ozone. So without ozone, the ultraviolet rays would break down amino acids, and cosmic radiation would have destroyed any amino acids that were formed. So the problem is you cannot form amino acids in the presence of oxygen, but they would break down and be destroyed in the absence of oxygen. And that's why they propose life and amino acids to be formed by heat vents in the ocean. Except that with all that water and a very dilute concentration of the chemicals, anything immediately formed would also immediately dissolve. In chemistry, that's called the law of hydrolysis. And that's why Miller, in his experiment showing how amino acids formed by naturalistic, unintelligent causes, sneakily placed an amino acid trap in the apparatus to immediately secure and isolate his end product before they could be destroyed. But even doing that, he only got two or three types of amino acids, not the 20 or so found in living things. And 50% of them were right-handed. That would be a big problem because all living things use only left-handed amino acids. I'll explain that in a few minutes. But first, let's look at an example of mixing right and left-handed things. Well, what would the left side of a car look like with right-sided parts on it? Let's try the door from the right side. No, we can't have the upholstery on the outside of the car. Well, now the paint is on the outside, but the door is upside down. We need the door the right way up. Well, now the door is right side up, but it's backwards. So as you can see, right-handed things, like doors and amino acids, cannot be where only left-handed things will work properly. Well, this supposedly naturally occurring pool of amino acids is called primordial soup. And if it existed, it would consist of equal portions of right and left-handed amino acids. Assuming that proteins formed spontaneously, that would give you proteins with both right and left-handed amino acids, such as those formed in test tubes in the laboratory. But only left-handed forms of amino acids are found in the proteins of any living organism. It's just sort of like the left side of your zipper jacket. If you put right-handed zips on the left side of your jacket, your zipper would blow apart and it wouldn't function properly. Similarly, any right-handed amino acids that are in living things can cause big problems. For example, that's what happened where the drug thalidomide was given and it caused birth defects. So back to Miller's fiasco. Finally, his end products were only 2 to 3% amino acid, 85% tar, which really gummed up the works and made the amino acids useless, and 13% carbolic acid and other toxic substances. So what does all this really mean? It means that there was no such thing as a primordial soup because there were no amino acids formed by naturalistic causes. And even if they were, given an eternity of time, no life would come about out of it. So you see what I mean when I say that the missing links are irrelevant, because evolution couldn't even have gotten started in the first place. It would be as if you were doing a 10-kilometer hike, but you never even took the first step. In point of fact, it seems that the building blocks of life are only made by living things. Well, this next illustration finishes off any possibility of evolution being valid, but it gets a bit thick. So I'll ask you to bear with me for a few minutes. I think you'll find that it is worth your while. Would any of you risk $100 on a bet where the chance of winning was only 1 in 100,000? I'd like you to think about that for a minute because it's really important. Would you bet your life on odds as poor as 1 in 100,000? I think only a fool would. That would be like having a room with 100,000 guns in it and only one of them was unloaded and you went in there to play Russian roulette. So you get my point. So keep in mind that the chance of one in a number with five zeros after it are really poor odds. Now, the distance from the Earth to the Sun, however, some 93 million miles, is only a number with 12 zeros after it in inches. So you remember the old game, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 100. See if you can guess it on the first guess. Well, I'm thinking of a specific inch between here and the Sun, 93 million miles away. See if you can guess which inch I'm thinking of on the first guess. Well, that sounds impossible, doesn't it? In point of fact, scientists agree that the mathematical definition of impossible, meaning that it would never happen, is one chance in a number followed by 50 zeros, where the distance to the Sun in inches is only a number followed by 12 zeros. So you get a really good idea why that's a good definition of impossible. And you'll see where this is going in just a moment. I'd like you to imagine that we had 26 cards labeled from A to Z, and using our intelligence, if we wanted to spell the word evolution, we could look at these cards and pick up the E first, and then the V, and then the O. But what is the likelihood of spelling evolution by chance random selection of the cards? It is one chance in 26 that you pick up the E first. One chance in 26 times one chance in 26 that you pick up the E first and then the V. One chance in 26 times one chance in 26 times one chance in 26 that you pick up the E, then the V, then the O. So in point of fact, if you were to pick up one card every second, it would take you an average of 86,000 years before you got those nine cards in order. But now let's make this even more challenging. Let's look at the probability of a protein forming, assuming that we had all the amino acids we could possibly want. If there are 20 basic right-handed amino acids and 20 basic left-handed amino acids, we can liken that to an alphabet with 40 letters in it with which to spell our protein. Hemoglobin has 574 amino acids in a row, so to speak. Actually, it's two alpha helixes, two beta helixes, and a porphyrin ring, but we'll consider that it's in a row. If you wanted to spell a hemoglobin protein with 574 amino acids in a row, it's one chance in 40 times one chance in 40, 574 times, that you're going to get the correct sequence. The way that works out in our base 10 mathematics is one chance in a number followed by 918 zeros. Or, basically, the probability is the same as a number with 868 zeros times the definition of impossible. And this probability is way beyond that definition of impossibility. And that's just for one protein. Whereas the average human cell has over 50,000 different proteins in it. And every one of those 50,000 beyond impossible proteins is just one more strand of floss evidence in your safety rope. Well, a safety rope with 50,000 floss-sized strand pieces of evidence would probably be about 3.5 feet in diameter. Well, we were talking earlier about whether 2,000 pieces of evidence would be adequate for you. I've just given you 50,000 pieces of evidence that directly support creation and stand against evolution. And I'm afraid that I am not so religious as to think that this was an accident. It takes far too much faith to believe that that could be a coincidence. And we discussed earlier whether anyone here would be fool enough to bet their life on odds of one chance in 100,000. Given these odds, given these probabilities, if you're not trusting your life to God's existence, to your creation by Him, and His plan for your eternal life, you are way beyond being a fool. And I think that's pretty clear. But each protein molecule not only has to have all the correct amino acids in the right order, but to actually function, it has to fold into a structure of the right shape. So let's take a look at this video clip.
There are at least 30,000 distinct types of proteins, each made of a different combination of the same 20 amino acids. They are arranged, like letters, to form chains, often hundreds of units long. If the amino acids are sequenced correctly, then the chain will fold into a functioning protein.
Proteins are arranged in such a way that their amino acids collapse on one another and form an architecture that's pre-programmed by the hundreds of amino acids along the protein chain. So the order of those amino acids inside of a protein is essential to getting the right shape.
This arrangement is critical, for if the amino acids are incorrectly sequenced, a useless chain forms, and instead of folding into a protein, it will be destroyed in the cell.
Well, you saw how the sequence of amino acids determined how they fold upon themselves, which further determines the shape and structure of a protein molecule itself. I'm now going to show you a simulation representing amino acids being laid down in a sequence to form a familiar shape. Well, as you can see, the shape formed in this simulation is a key. This specific shape will allow this key, representative of a specific protein, to do a specific job. Proteins have a certain shape and a structure to them, just like a key. Well, this is my key ring. And as you can tell, I have several different keys on it. There are some car keys, some office keys, some house keys, a mail key, a security key, and a useless rubber chicken that doesn't do anything. I suppose it would be more convenient if I only needed one key for everything, but the shape of each key determines its use. Since the shape of each key determines its use, the shape of over 50,000 different proteins in each cell determines their usage. So how critical is it that all the amino acids are in the correct order? What about only one wrong one or one right-handed one? As you can see in the next slide, the entire structure is correct, except that at one position I changed one angle. By changing the angle at only one position, like changing one amino acid on a protein, the entire protein becomes useless for its assigned task. So let's look at some other probabilities which are beyond impossible. Excuse me. Sir Frederick Hoyle, a famous astronomer, tried to calculate the possibility of life evolving by random chance. His conclusion was roughly one chance in a number followed by 40,000 zeros, or roughly the equivalent of a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and assembling a Boeing 747. I like the way Carl Sagan put it. He was heavily involved in the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They have all these big radio telescopes scattered around the country that can supposedly monitor 28 million frequencies per second. And they are listening for some kind of a coded message from space, something to distinguish itself from background radiation noise and static. If they got a coded message like, "Hi, fellas, we're here," they would say that, obviously, there is intelligent life out there. DNA, however, is not only the most complex molecule in the entire universe, even according to Sagan, it is also the equivalent of 500,000 single-space, typewritten, small-font pages of digital code. But Sagan, who is an atheist, insists that it is not a message created by an intelligence. Interestingly, Carl Sagan himself admitted in his book, Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that the chance of spontaneously forming that the chance of spontaneously having life appear on Earth is one chance in a number followed by 2 billion zeros. Now, to give you an idea about the size of this number, there's 7.5 billion people on the planet. That's a lot of people, but the number itself only has 9 zeros after it. But to give you an idea of the size of a number with 2 billion zeros, my pen tip is about a millimeter in diameter. If the zeros were a millimeter in diameter and touching each other, just to write a number with 2 billion zeros would stretch from here to south of San Francisco. That's 2,000 kilometers long. Well, unfortunately for Carl Sagan, he was an atheist when he died, but he isn't one now. He knows that God exists. So let's look at the complexity of the DNA and the chromosomes. The average human cell has over 50 trillion cells. The total DNA from all of these cells would only fill about 2 tablespoons. And yet, if all the chromosomes from one person were stretched out and laid end to end, they would stretch from the Earth to the Moon and back 5 million times. The code in the chromosomes is so complex, it's more complex and holds more information than all of the computer programs ever written by man combined. The coded information contained in the chromosomes of one human being, if typed out, would fill enough books to fill the Grand Canyon 40 times. And so here's a Carl Sagan, or a representation of him, saying, "Any day now we'll pick up a tiny coded message, then we will know for certain that there is intelligence out there, because coded information does not arise by chance." And yet in the classroom, what are they teaching us? The precisely coded information in each cell will fill many books, but there is no reason to think that intelligence created them. This is exactly the sort of thing that made me so angry when I realized it. Is your common sense angry? Anybody here ever try a Rubik's Cube? I hate them. Sir Frederick Hoyle also said, "Now imagine 10 to the 50th of blind people, or that's 100,000 billion, 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 billion people. Standing shoulder to shoulder, they would more than fill our entire planetary system. And picture each one of them with a scrambled Rubik's Cube and try and conceive of the chance of them all simultaneously arriving at the solved form." I couldn't even arrive at the solved form with my eyes open. He says, "You then have the chance of arriving by random shuffling or random variation of just one of the many biopolymers on which life depends." That's one protein. The notion that not only biopolymers, but also the operating program, that's the DNA, of a living cell could arrive by chance in a primordial soup here on Earth is evidentially nonsense of the highest order. That's Sir Frederick Hoyle saying that. So what did I do with my Rubik's Cube? I put it out of my misery. Well, finally, we come to what is probably my favorite form of evidence from biochemistry, physiology, and anatomy. Dr. Michael Behe, a biochemist, coined the term irreducible complexity. If you wanted to catch some mice, for example, you wouldn't put a platform down by the mouse hole, catch a few mice, and say, "Gee, that were great. It would probably do even better if I added a spring." In fact, the mousetrap is irreducibly complex, with the platform, the spring, the hammer, the trigger, the locking mechanism, the staples, and the bait. And each one of these components has certain parameters that it must meet. The hammer has to be long enough to reach over to where the mouse is. The trigger has to be sensitive enough to let go when it's triggered. The spring has to be strong enough to slam down with the adequate force. And it doesn't function at all unless it's complete with everything working properly. Well, I'll come back to this concept in just a minute. Does anyone have any idea what this is? I'll give you a hint, it's only about that tall. It's an arrowhead. Well, I'd like you to consider, were the Indians really just a lucky bunch who found millions of these things naturally occurring and scattered all across the countryside? Did they then realize, "Hey, look at this, the bottom edge is sharp, we can insert that into a stick, and it's got these notches so that we can tie it onto a stick. It's sharp along both sides and at the very tip so it can go into an animal, and it's got those notches to keep it from pulling out of an animal. We can use these things for hunting. Aren't we lucky that these things have just naturally been scattered around the countryside?" If I said that to you, you'd say, "Don't be an idiot. Obviously, that arrowhead was designed and created by the Indians for a purpose." So let's look at a couple of charts representing the biochemical pathways within the human body. Unfortunately, it doesn't show up very well there. But I do have the charts here if you want to have a look at them. The reason I said that these charts represent the biochemical pathways of the human body is because there are only about 2,500 proteins on them. And as I stated, a single human has over 50,000 different proteins in a cell. There's the second one. So really, to be accurate, if you were just counting the number of proteins, I'd need another 19 sets of these charts. So you see, we, just like the mousetrap, are irreducibly complex. We have to have all of these proteins, hormones, catalysts, et cetera, and all at once and right from the very beginning of our existence. And it doesn't work at all unless it's complete and everything is functioning properly. For example, if you don't have insulin, which is a little orange word on there someplace, you die from diabetes. If you don't have testosterone, if you're a guy, you don't reproduce and the species dies out. What about the difficulties of male and female supposedly evolving separately with all their different hormones and equipment, and yet evolving rapidly enough for the first generation of the species not to die out before mating, let alone expecting that these complex reproductive devices would all work perfectly the first time? Once again, it is clear that the arrowhead was designed and created with a purpose in mind. But for me to believe that all of these proteins and their biological pathways just happened by accident requires far more faith than I've got. That's just way too religious for me. I'm a science guy. Keep in mind that aside from the chemicals, we also have stereoscopic eyes that see in 3D and color, a brain with 100 trillion electrochemical synapses, a complex series of muscles, which together with a bony skeleton provide the levers, pulleys, and powers for complex and precision movement. We have a nervous system which provides sensory input and motor output for us to do things, along with a system that automatically keeps our heart and breathing going, regulates our temperature, digests our food, etc. We have a vascular system which supplies oxygen and nutrients and components of immunity and repair to every area of our bodies and removes waste material. These and myriad other complexities show us plainly to be the creation of a precise and caring God. And as Dr. Michael Denton points out, the conclusion may have religious implications, but it does not depend on religious presuppositions. It's all science, baby. You remember I told you that this whole study into the evidence for creation as opposed to evolution began for me when I said, I have to believe this Bible is true. Well, hopefully with what I've shown you today, you say, I have to believe this is true. But what's more important is this, is to believe that God and his written word, the Bible, are true. So now I'd like you to imagine that you're trying to escape from Nazi Germany. If someone gave you a map and they proved to you that it was reliable, and it showed you the one route that you must take to attain freedom, safety, peace, and happiness, and it also showed you all the wrong routes which led to capture, torture, and certain death, wouldn't you make sure you knew that map explicitly and followed it so that it would lead to your safety? Well, this is that map. And now I'd like to take just a moment to tie up some loose ends and help you to know for certain that you are on the right route. Don't bet your eternal life on a wager that you cannot possibly win. Hopefully, I've shown you that evolution is beyond impossible, and that the only alternative makes it clear that we have a loving creator who is in the miracle-making business. This makes true all of those positive answers to the philosophical questions that I asked in the beginning, that we have been created by a loving God for a purpose, and that is fellowship with him and with each other. Hundreds of those prophecies that I mentioned in this book predict that God himself will come to earth in the form of a man. His place of birth in Micah 5:2, his manner of birth in Isaiah 7:14, his time of birth in Daniel 9:24-27 were all predicted hundreds of years in advance. He came to die a sacrificial death as a substitutionary payment for our sins in fulfillment of the Old Temple sacrifice. What sins, you may ask? Well, God gave us the Ten Commandments. And has any one of us never told a lie or stolen even the smallest item or lusted, which makes us guilty of committing adultery in our hearts? We're all guilty of breaking God's law and would be sentenced to an eternity in an actual place called hell. Except that God, through Christ, our prophesied Messiah, and his death on the cross and resurrection, cancels our sin debt, and grants us eternal life in heaven. Well, this has changed my life in exciting and phenomenal ways, and I can now watch the news on TV with the peace that comes from knowing that my future is secure and guaranteed. If you have never seriously invited Jesus into your heart, why don't you take a moment and pray and ask God to come into your life? This will absolutely change your destiny. I thank you for your attention and your patience. You've all been great. There was too much to take notes on, but we have a handout which is putting some of the key points in your hands. Thank you.